K210 fan.
You know how when they yell cut, they wouldn't stop.
That's interesting.
What?
Yes.
If you were Donna, what would you have said?
A waitress rather call the police. And she was mistaken for 210 for cops.
Along with your host, Charles Rosen.
Look at that Dean cake. And Dan probably got the best performance he ever gave.
We're having a meeting here.
Oh, at least there's one person on this Fricata set that knows what they're doing.
Larry Mullen.
I had a friend named Craig Richland. There was still cocaine around and stuff. I always remembered him. I just kind of thought I would honor my coke dealer.
Get out of here.
Pete Ferrero.
Here's what I learned. It's possible Claire would have gone out with me.
That was your takeaway.
So sit back and relax because it's like totally time for the Beverly Hills 90210 show.
Just hold on to me tonight.
Okay, here we are back on the Beverly Hills 90210 show. We are covering today A Good Bad Boy, a book that is now out and everybody's super excited. We're going to bring the author, Margaret Wappler, on in a second here. But first off, Chuck Rosen, how are things with you?
Well, it's stopped raining and the wind has stopped. The rain's coming back in the weekend. But at this point, when you get to be where I'm going through in life and whatever, every day matters. Every day counts. I saw Lisa yesterday in Torrance. I was down there doing a thing for their career day. So that was fun.
Someone just asked, can you please put 90210 again on? And it's all I grew up with. We're not the network. We're not gonna. Okay, Larry.
No, I did figure out though how you could do it.
Okay,
I think I messaged you. It's 90210 AI.
Oh, amazing! Yes,
just
that's totally it.
Continue with the characters, sample them, and then just write new stuff with them as that age, and just pick it up.
Oh, it's such a brilliant idea. That is great,
Larry. 90210 AI. Here we are,
Larry Mullen. How are you?
Good. I'm in Carmel by the sea. I don't know if you can see the sea there, but it's really pretty here. We're going to be having a nice dinner here and just catching up with friends.
And Brian from Reddit, how are things at Reddit?
Good. Nice and steady. Every day, so many posts.
Anything controversial that we should be aware of?
Controversial?
I'm always love when...
I'm sure there's something. There's always something.
When someone's triggered on Reddit by something that happened on a show from 30 years ago, that's...
You know, you know what it is, Pete? I now figure this out. We've known each other. We've worked together now for a number of years.
Yes.
Part of you's got a Jerry Springer quality, right? You just want to see them beat each other up with chairs.
I kind of love it. I kind of love it. Every once in a while, I'll take a different position. I was team Brenda or team Kelly, and then it really gets them all very excited. So, all right, we're going to bring on the author. We're going to play an ad. I can't wait to get into this. Luke Perry is one of my favorite topics, and that's what we're talking about today. So we'll be right back.
Hey, Beverly Hills 90210 fans. Check out all the latest rad stuff from the Beverly Hills 90210 show shop. They have everything you could possibly imagine. So, like, go there now, okay?
Okay, well, we are being joined by Margaret Wappler. Am I saying that right?
You got it.
And I remember we met a while back at a coffee shop out here, and you told me all about this. How are you, first of all?
I'm good. You know, the book has been out for a few weeks, so it's nice to see it take on its own life after, you know, working on it for a while. And yeah, it's just exciting to kind of see all the reaction.
Go ahead, Chuck. What you got? I mean, Chuck called me after he read this book. So excited. And I want to let you say what you said to me when you called me. But he said,
what I said after I called him was, I think that you've written the book that every super fan would have wanted to write.
Oh,
because
that's good.
What makes it so special, and although I'm going to want to talk to you on a couple of different things here and there, as a contrarian like myself would, But it was really the part of when you put in your own family life and your life and the relationship to the show as it was going on. I can't tell you how many nights I would sit around, and this is the high school years, Larry, before we would get into it. And no, especially when the show started on its ascent and just started to go like, well, who's watching that? Who's our audience? Who is watching the show? Who watches Fox? Who is this? I was really much more of an MTM. And HBO didn't take off till I was already, I was lodged in this. But that was where I, if you would have said, what's your sensibility? I was a movie writer. I wrote movies. And so here I am with this series. And only once did we get to see a little smirmer of it when Fox News showed all the parties on our commencement episode. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, well, that's, you know, okay, there's our fan base in Norwalk. That's them. But who was our fan? What were they going through? And you did that so beautifully in this book. And I was so excited. And I then I left him that message and then started to read. I said, oh, wait a second. The acknowledgments. I got to read the acknowledgments. Because I saw the book when I go to Book Soup. And I've been in West Hollywood a lot recently for all these, seeing all these doctors. And so I went to my favorite bookstore, and there you were. I went, oh, great, I'm going to read this. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to read the acknowledgments because, you know, I didn't look at that. I just read the book, finished the book, called Pete.
Mm-hmm. You did do that.
Mm-hmm. And what I didn't read, didn't realize in the acknowledgments, didn't remember when we were in the acknowledgments. Said, we talked. You're acknowledging. Thanks for talking to me.
And I explained to him that he had talked.
My response is, "Oh my God, I am reach. I crossed the line. I am now. I was once the person my friends called for the minute details of what time and what day this happened, and now I can't even remember that what went on allegedly on December 2022."
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'm going to refresh your memory that no, I can't.
I looked at there. I was going through a terrible, lots of different stuff going on with our housing.
I remember.
My poor granddaughter. Yeah. Life is better for all now in those regards. Thanks so much. But it was fun to realize that. And then I remembered the key element about the conversation that I remember impressed me when we talked and why I had confidence I would see this book because you said the three magic words, Simon and Schuster. And I said, well, you're not alone in this. You're not some fan. You're wired. And and I know that Larry, you know, we look at the book jackets here. Larry has a relationship with Amy Schumer.
Oh, right? Really?
I'm not misrepresenting that. And I know Molly Lambert from way back.
She's a giant fan. Okay.
So there you are. So you this is really great pedigree you have here, and you've written it beautifully. And now I'll shut up and wait for my turn to really ask a lot of questions.
Tammy says, I love the book. I didn't put it down until I finished the entire book. Fantastic. So, hey, Tammy.
Tammy, really sorry about Baltimore.
Oh, yeah.
So much going on there.
Yeah. Really sorry, Tammy,
I want to say I read the book right away and got back to Margaret because I expected kind of like an exploitative kind of biography. And I think that's usually what you see in these things. They just get turned out and, you know, whatever. And because you took you made the book special by putting yourself into it, it really elevated it and it gave it a context and it made it special. And I lauded you for it. I
and a very cinematic quality, by the way, which I'm sure read your book and think along those lines. I hope people would someday think about, well, boy, yeah, there could be a motion picture here because it's an interesting set of relationships whenever you do the relationship between fans and a show. It's always there.
And the fans have really been excited, I have to say. They really are energized by it. So our fans of the podcast, they like it. I mean, so that's
I love it.
That's your core audience. And now, you know, when it gets translated into Hebrew, you're going to really do some story. You're going to score some big, big royalty checks. What do you think, Chef?
Okay, I'll try for those.
You got Israel. I'll take you at Italy. I know the Italians love your book.
Those are really giant fans.
Rabid fans. as there are all over different countries all over the
multi-generational,
world.
Multi-generational.
I feel like Australia, I mean, it doesn't have to be translated for Australia, but there are so many fans in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
Australia was there right from the start. They were in the first round with Canada, the UK, and Australia, and that was it. And pretty much in the first part of it. And it was fun for us because our associate producer, Livia Hanisch, was from Australia. So, she we got the news. How do people like it back home, you know, as we were. You know.
Margaret, walk me into this. Mm-hmm. How did this start for you? Being a 90210 fan, we can go all the way back.
Yeah.
And then also wanting to write this about Luke.
Yeah, well, I mean, to go back all the way to when the show was on, I really was the perfect target audience for the show because I was a 14-year-old girl entering high school at the exact time that David Silver is entering high school. And, you know, I watched it in a way as like instruction, like what is high school supposed to be like? You know, what are social groups about? Like, where am I going to fit in? And it was, you know, I also think that 90210 is so special because it just reached such an enormous audience. I mean, you can just take any show now that might have critical acclaim like Euphoria or something, and it just simply does not reach the sheer numbers of people that 90210 did. It was like in the era where we all watch things together still.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there was something so beautiful about that, that like, you know, when I was going back into the show and rewatching it, and just talking with friends about it, like, you know, friends my age, like, you know, people, all kinds of people watching it, like people who identify as like goths and punks and, you know, popular kids and jocks and like everybody watched it.
You know, and guys watched it so they had something to talk to girls about.
Yes. I mean, that came up in the book a couple of times, like Rory Karp, friend of the show, like talking about how he first started watching it because he wanted to like impress his crush at the time. Yeah, so I mean, that was, you know, obviously that was like the first encounter, and that was the first encounter with Luke, and I had a, you know, crush on him, and I thought he was the coolest, and I thought, and the thing too is that like I think there's this automatic assumption that because I'm a woman, I would like have a crush on him, and that's it. But I also kind of wanted to be him, you know, like there is this kind of duality for me of like I wanted to be that cool, and like I had some of the same scars that he did, you know, like I really related to, as you see in the book, like the loss of a father and like, you know, really feeling like who's gonna love me, like you're searching for that love, which I think a lot of high school kids relate to, even if you don't have some kind of trauma going on. But yeah, so then jumping forward many years, hold on, I'm trying to get out of the light in my house.
That's okay.
So a good friend of mine wrote his obituary for the New York Times, and she is friends with Taffy Bredesser Ackner, and she is friends with Sean Manning, Simon & Schuster editor. And they started talking about like, what if this was a book? And she was like, I know a person who I think could really do a good job with this. And so she put me in touch with Sean, and I came to Sean being like, you know, I don't want to write your typical biography. I just feel like it needs more. Like there's something about the larger than life teen idol-ness of him that I wanted to bring to life in a different way. And partially too, because I knew that like, you know, he was a pretty humble guy and there wasn't going to be like skeletons in his closet. You know, there wasn't going to be some things that normally fire a biography. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you know, there has to be an X factor. There has to be something else. And we kind of experimented with a couple different ways and really early on. And it was like, oh, my story clicks with this in terms of like, yeah, having kind of a similar story to Dylan's, also relating to Luke in a certain way. Like I came from kind of a working class background. I had certain experiences that I could relate to, the Midwest upbringing, all of those things. So yeah, it was just, that was the way to get into it. And it made it just so much more meaningful for me. And I think a lot of fans, like when he died, we all had that moment of like your whole life kind of like flushes by you where you're like, oh yeah, I was 14 when I watched that show. I was, by the time it went off the air, I was out of college, you know, in my first job. Then, you know, like the relationships that you have in your life, and you think about where you were when Luke was doing like Oz, you know, it just kind of, I wanted to like sort of bring that to life, to sort of like open that flash into a whole book. So that was part of the idea.
I love it. And you know, even talking about his passing was just so shocking for so many of us fans, you know. I remember I couldn't do anything because I was just like totally floored by what was happening. Someone that we just, that was just beloved and just such a part of our hearts in the 90210 verse and growing up. Chuck, do you have, what are your, some of your thoughts and some of your questions?
Well, we'll go to that. I'll leave the thoughts out because the one I was gonna get too many people mad at me, I think, just even thinking about that. You know, the interesting thing, one of the things specific that you talked about, because it's interesting, you talked about, you went on beyond 902. You did it really well. And so you're talking about what was the most important thing to Luke as he was in his, really in the early years, certainly the second year of 902.0, which was 8 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
To think that 90210 was the most important thing in it, in his, that mattered to the most, and what was going, not, no, 8 seconds was really what propelled the beast, as it were. The beast being the bull itself, you know. And the, and Luke, some ways, he's a gentle guy, sweet guy, humble, all the things you say, but he also saw himself as a bull. He also saw himself, the tough guy. You know, we wanted to write him as a tough guy. And he projected that out. And when we were choreographing the first scene in the first episode where he slugs the guy in the tech room.
Yes.
And it was like, and the guy kind of cowers. It's like, oh, come on, he's not that big. I mean, you know, a big middle, you know, linebacker type in the Midwest is going to pound the shit out of you, Dylan McKay, you know. But, he projected all of that. And so it was interesting for you to give him that bay and that space. And I often now, looking back at I'm often seeing like a lot of stuff having to do with Luke, almost like being part of a jigsaw puzzle. And, oh, well, that's why this was happening then. Because the one thing that you don't talk about with that is that how many times Mr. Spelling tried to talk him out of doing the movie.
8 seconds.
Did you mention that? Did you reference that?
No, I didn't, but that doesn't surprise me.
Oh, my God. And also the most so interesting part, when you had the part about Luke Perry knocking Nick Savalas at the party, I couldn't believe how you knew all of that kind of stuff, because I've never shared this with anybody. Mr. Spelling used to spend many of our sessions just talking about his fear of Tori, what's going to happen to Tori, because her date smokes crack. And they knew he smoked crack, and there was crack there, and is Tori smoking crack? And I'm like, oh, I don't know, Aaron. I mean, you know, I didn't have a relationship with him that he should be unloading that kind of real family burden, but I took it and listened and commiserated, during that. And then, you know, it be faded to the background, but I never had heard the story where Luke shows up and had him back off, because that was probably one of the reasons he felt enabled to do that, is he too knew how much Aaron needed a friend at that moment.
Margaret, talk about that story in the book.
Did you try to reach Nick Savalas by any chance? Did you try to interview him?
No, and I didn't, in part because, you know, I didn't want to foreground his story really, or get tangled in did it happen exactly? Okay. Or more like, I didn't want to like
I'm your confirmation that he's a bad guy, and I've never met him.
Well, I didn't want to relitigate the relationship between him and Tori. Exactly. I really just wanted to like focus on what Luke did for a good friend. That was a part of it. Right. And, you know, it is kind of interesting. It does kind of, there is a commentary about masculinity there where, like, you know, he wasn't a big, physically big man. You know, that kind of came up a number of times in interviews, as people talking about him being like somewhat like small in stature. And like, I mean, that's you know, neither here nor there. Like, obviously, like, you can be a very masculine person and a small person, but like, all the same, like, he kind of had this interesting relationship, I think, to masculinity. Like, and in a situation like that, I think the traditional quality of masculinity that he was most interested in was defending someone he loved. You know what I mean? Like, being there for a good friend and a woman and protecting her. And I think that did come back to his background of like seeing his biological father be abusive to his mother and being the 6-year-old kid who was powerless to stop it. And, you know, I think that that stayed with him throughout his life, that kind of real, like, I'm going to defend the underdog. I'm going to protect women, and like, kind of the most like lovely traditional sense of that word, and not in like an overbearing sense of that. And I, yeah, that story just really stood out to me as like all of those things dovetailing, you know?
So can I ask a question, Pete? I was reading today in the email you sent, Pete, to about what Art Magazine had said and the relationship that Art Magazine feels towards Luke.
AARP?
AARP, their magazine. They wrote about it and the book and what you put there. It's a very nice piece. But one of the things I learned from that is that the family did not talk to you?
No, they didn't. You know, the family, for one thing, there's different parts of the family. And, you know, I did have some kind of communication with just about all the major players. Like, you know, I sent emails and communications to his kids, his ex-wife, his fiance, his sister. And, you know, for, they all had kind of different reasons for not wanting to participate. And, you know, I was pretty sad about that for a while. And I still feel like if they had participated, like, it would be even more of an opportunity to really like extend his legacy. Like, this book extended his legacy. I really believe that.
Yes.
And like, they had an opportunity.
Well, we'll continue to. It's a classic approach. This is going to, you know, this for the next generation coming up. We'll read this to learn about the era and the person and stuff. Yes, no, it will be read. That's what's, I think, so exciting about your book.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, so I was disappointed, you know, and like, but obviously, like I said, I mean, and I don't want to speak for them, like, people had different reasons. And in the end, it just felt like, okay, you know, I was more drawn at any rate to like his acting and his career trajectory. I thought what he went through as an actor was really interesting and hard. Like, it's hard to experience this like meteoric rise of fame and then to kind of have, and then to get pigeonholed into that character and not be allowed to sort of like break free a bit.
Oh, I disagree with that. I have to call you on your bullshit.
Yeah? What do you disagree
with? I think that's completely 100%
get
wrong.
Into it. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Here we go.
Yeah.
What parts did he get? The only part that he got pigeonholed doing was seasons 9 and 10 when he needed the dough.
Yeah, well, I think,
Cincinnati, he worked with Tom Fontana, who I worked with in St. Elsewhere, one of the really fine writers. He worked with David Milch, although not real success, bad David Milch, unfortunately.
Oh, Cincinnati, Josh from Cincinnati.
He got to pitch all over town and be in things. He did theater. The thing that I was going to call, and then we'll talk about it now, but I'm friends with Mark Damon Espinosa, so I'm going to tease him over in the part that you talked about when he was lamenting. It seemed like this was not from the 90s, but more recently, Luke was, you know, frustrated in the role of Dylan McKay, and I'm sorry that he's not around so I can give him shit for even because he wanted to change where his focus was romantically. He got that, he got that. He got exactly that. He wanted to have a plot that was intricate and detailed and not what would be expected. And of course there was, and he got that with the money being stolen, not to mention the whole plot of his father and the whole, what do you do with that? And you're dealing with your inner child and you're dealing with things that are, you get into your own head and you're doing that, you almost die of a heroin overdose and you're in your own dreams. What was he typed as in 9?
Okay, let's let Margaret
type him as.
Well, I mean, listen, you guys gave him plenty of juicy stuff to play with. That's, I mean, and I don't blame you guys for pigeonholing him. I think the public perception is what pigeonholed him.
And yeah, let me tell you, now I'm an old guy, so I don't give a shit anymore. And but we had that for a long time, that somehow the writers of Beverly Hills 90210, oh, can you imagine what if, you know, if they were different, right? What would they be doing? No, what would they be doing?
But let me tell you a story of how I think he got burned in a way by being Dylan McKay. In fact, I know he got burned by being Dylan McKay in this particular instance. So like Normal Life, a movie that he does with John McNaughton, a director, and then he's acting with Ashley Judd. And it's a story based on these real life, you know, Chicago suburban people that couldn't achieve the American dream and they turned to bank robbing. It's a real story. Like they just suddenly flipped and turned into bank robbers. And it's a really good movie. And it's also really good because it's all about the middle class just being like an unachievable thing, which has even more resonance now than back then. But Luke did so well in this movie. You know, this movie is 96 and it goes out and tests in audiences in San Francisco suburbs. And these San Francisco suburbs, people say, I don't want to see Dylan McKay wielding a shotgun and being a bad guy, a bank robber. This is my teen crush. This is my sweet little high school bad boy. He can't be that guy. And they, New Line, who, you know, got behind the movie at first, they buried it. They were like, this isn't going to work. He's the star. People can't take him in this role. We're going to just trash this movie. And all they did was release it into a handful of theaters in New York, LA, and Chicago. And that, to me, like looking, like going back and seeing that movie now, I mean, I
feel like belting a chorus of "There's no business like show business."
I mean, I know.
I'm
there's
serious, a I'm serious. That does not derail an entire career. Excuse me.
Well,
what you're talking about is a setback. I can tell you setbacks, and I can tell you setbacks that derail careers. That was because you know why? Because that nice movie can be 3 years later or 2 years later given to a casting director to see and say, God, yeah, that's so much different than I thought. Yeah, you're exactly. I got to change the perception. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Did you interview Sid Levin? Did you interview his manager?
No, I tried to reach out to her a number of times. Well,
that was not a strength. That was not one of Luke's strengths. And I think you can ask any of the people who run into in a 90210 capacity. I think they would kind of not acknowledge that there were other management groups that may have, he was a very loyal to his friends.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I don't think that like, I mean, I do, I think most of what happened in Luke's career was, honestly, it was like a lot of bad luck. It's like he kept getting certain opportunities that should have blown him up, like the David Milch show and like Oz, which did actually, Oz did, I think, raise his profile. But like, take the David Milch show, for instance. Like, you have David Milch hot off of Deadwood, this really cool, interesting show, critically acclaimed. It's like John from Cincinnati should have been the next hit. And instead, it was this confounding, you know, muddle of ideas that, interesting, but, you know, it didn't take off in HBO
Canada. They had a deal and they are contractually obligated to make it. If any of you put that name on anybody else's script, it would have never, I believe, would have never gotten a green light. It was a contractual obligation to a very successful writer. And he got one more after that with the horse racing show, and then HBO tore that up.
Cincinnati was written by was based on the book by Kim Nunn. I mean, you remember Kim Nunn? Right. He wrote Tapping the Source, the great surfing book.
I was so excited to have Luke be in a surfing show.
That's how I felt.
It would have been perfect.
Fans would know. The ocean, yeah. And then
the problem was that Milch couldn't deliver the pages also. The production was stalled half the time.
David was having
so Mark Tinker told me he was a director of that thing, and he would complain about the fact they just would sit for days without anything to shoot.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I mean, John McNaughton, who I was like just talking about, he was a director on John from Cincinnati too. And he had great stories about just like, you know, David Milch would just get like a wild hair and like be like, okay, let's do this now. And it would just derail like days of shooting. And yeah, it was a mess.
So, you know, I'm just saying that, yes, you know, but the thing that's important is not in what, was this a good movie? Was this a good role? Was this a good, But look at the human being that came out of this.
Yeah.
Look at this uniformly loved guy, and we have the term the mensch. You know, he was a wonderful guy. Now, Charles and Karen got a real young version of him, and all the sharp elbows, they were directed to us. But he came over here. There was a wonderful party we had when we moved to, I live in Venice Beach in LA. And when we first moved here, my kids, who range from ages like 33 to 39, particularly the girls who were 35 and 39 and were in the show, wanted to see the cast again. And so we had a party for the 20th anniversary of them graduating from West Beverly High. And Jason and his wife came, and Luke came, unfortunately, with his fiance. Unfortunately, his kids were not going to be able to join him that Sunday when, you know, the divorced dad thing. But Gabby came, and Jenny came, and Stephen, and Ian and Brian came through media. And it was just a really, and Michael Cudlitz came, and it was a really good, warm time. And it was great to be Luke, because Luke and I had the one other passion in common, which was politics.
I remember and that, yeah.
He talked about Sherrod Brown the whole time he was here. Who's anybody, super fans in Ohio, you owe it to Luke to vote for Sherrod Brown.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
One of the touching stories in the book is this story about Jason's car wreck. Mm-hmm. And that Luke goes to stay with Jason. You want to share a little bit about what you were told about that, Margaret?
Yeah. So Jason, as we all know, was a race car driver for quite some time, and he got into a hideous car wreck in Kentucky. And he, you know, basically for a couple minutes was literally pronounced dead, you know, on the scene. And he gets into the hospital. Obviously, he's back alive, but he's extremely banged up, like broken legs, you know, face unrecognizable, all that. And Luke, who often lived part-time in Tennessee, like got word that this had happened. And he just like went out to Jason right away, got to his bedside. You know, Jason at this point, despite like all kinds of people coming into the room who he loved, like hadn't spoken yet. And the doctors were starting to worry that he was just, you know, mentally not there. And Luke got into his face and he said, Jay, it's Luke. I'm here. And that was what made Jason say, it's Coy Luther Perry, you know. And it was really funny that he said that full name, which was a name that Luke hated, because that was his biological father's name, who he's named after. And he felt no connection to that person. So it was like unclear whether like Jason was kind of ribbing him right in that moment. Like the nurses were like, wait, who's he talking about? This is Luke Perry, not like.
Right.
Yeah. But it was a beautiful moment, you know, between friends, like just a really another moment that I just really loved when I read about that in Jason's memoir. But then also like saw some old like, you know, Good Morning America show about it as well.
So, yeah, it's really touching. Chuck, I know you were touched by that story.
Touched about it when the first time I heard it. Think of a world without Jason and Luke would be pretty tough for him. It's hard enough sometimes we don't have Luke, you know. As I say, I really would like to give him shit. And him and me, you know, when he wrote, when I left the show, he wrote something to me, something like, you know, we went around almost every day and I wouldn't have had it any other. We sparred almost every day. I wouldn't have had it, wanted any other way. And I feel the same, so. You know, mm-hmm. Jason and I were both in Toronto at the site. I was doing a TV show up there, and he had moved there, was up there working and partying. And that was like in 2001. So this was not that long after that.
Yeah, really close to that time.
Larry, do you have any questions or thoughts?
No, I mean, I want to hear what Brian, what are people saying about it in Reddit? I want to hear what the crazy fans are saying.
You know, I've actually been getting messages on Instagram. You know, I made a post on Instagram and on Reddit as well. The Reddit post was got a lot of attention about the book, and people are, I mean, they love it, of course. I mean, the super fans are just eating it up. What I'll say is, for me, it really humanized Luke for me, you know, because from a fan standpoint, you don't really know what these people are like outside of the show. And, you know, reading all these stories, like the one with Jason and the accent, you know, it really, you get a sense of who Luke really was as a person. I think he did a fantastic job doing that. One that stood out to me was the section with Mark, where he says, you know, every time Luke would see him, he'd hug him and pull on his ears, the Dumbo ears.
Yeah.
You know, that's something I would have never expected, you know, Luke to be such an affectionate person to do something like that.
Well, yeah. the thing I have heard through the years too, and I was talking to Rory Karp today, and he says hi, and he is so happy that he did this book, and he was very touched about the chapter that you put with him towards the end of the book about how Luke brought them together, and he thought you did a really wonderful job. But one of the things I think that I've heard a lot through doing this podcast is how Luke would randomly run into people or check up on them. He would call and check up on them. And it's no secret, and I'm curious to know what she told you, but it's no secret that Rebecca Gayheart, who was somebody in the later seasons, Chuck, so this is not going to be in your world, but she is the character of Tony, and that Rebecca Gayheart, we haven't talked about on this show, but had a horrific incident, an accident in which she hit a child while pulling out of something or whatever. And Luke Perry checked in on Rebecca Gayheart. And did she speak to you about this, Margaret?
Yeah. I mean, she didn't go into the details of that accident, but, you know, it's public. You can read about it. It's very sad. You know, she basically struck a child while pulling up around a car, and the child unfortunately died a day later from his injuries. And she plunged into a real depression after that. Which she talked about on a podcast, you know, just how much she really, you know, in her own words, said she didn't want to live. And a lot of friends, she told me, faded away. You know, it was like kind of hard for people to even know what to say or how to comfort her because it was such a tragic thing. But Luke was one of the people that stuck around. And not only did he stick around, but he would just kind of pop in on her, you know, like unexpectedly, just, hey, how you doing? But he also was really good about knowing not to be like heavy with his presence, you know, not to be like, let's talk about it. Like he just would hang out. He would just be easy and just like make her laugh and be a friend, you know? And I think that's something that like, I really took something away from that story of like, you know, I think at times in my life when I've tried to be a good friend, I've maybe come in like too heavy in a way and like kind of wanted to like almost be the therapist or something. And like,
that's make it all better kind of a thing, right? Yeah. Huh? Make it all better, fix it, right?
Yeah. Fix it. Yeah. Like, you can't, you know, and sometimes the best thing you can do is just be like a light, easy, fun presence, you know, for somebody. And so she was just so, you know, and I love too that like, I think Luke was one of those people that sometimes he just knew about people. Like, you know, he saw her picture, they shared an agent, but he didn't really know her. And he was like, I want her to play. You know, my kind of last leading lady on 90210. And, you know, she stepped in and they really were like good friends and stayed good friends all throughout and worked together on other things. So, yeah, I thought her story with him was really touching, really like a lovely tribute to him.
Justina says Luke was a perfect example of what it means to be a real friend. And she also bought it in multiple formats, ebook, audio, and hardcover. I guess she likes to have it covered.
Yeah, she covered all the bases. I love it. Yeah. Literally. I mean, there's been so many fans that have like, I'm really grateful for the fact that, you know, I did something a little different with this book. And a lot of the fans have come along for the ride. You know, like, I definitely knew there would be some people that would be like skeptical and like, what's her story have to do with it? And I think if you... you know, you sort of strap in and you say, I'm going to be open to this journey. Like you're going to get a lot out of it, you know? And I feel like the fans who took that on, I'm just so grateful for them.
Was it difficult to try to get the cast to participate?
Yeah. I mean, I think once I didn't have the family sort of officially, you know, put their official stamp on it, I think the cast, it was a hard get. I mean, I didn't really talk to any of the main people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Jenny Garth, I think we got really close and there was like a couple things on the books and then it would just like fall apart. And I think it was, you know, some scheduling stuff as much as anything. You know, to be honest, I kind of felt like in a way it freed me, you know, and it kind of allowed me to cover other things about his
life. Absolutely. It didn't tether you. I mean, Mark too, because Mark's different because Mark was, you know, not there in the high school years. So in that way was more of an outsider, as that were, and really, so added the perspective of an outsider, which was great. But the others, you know, you don't have the family, as you say, you don't have the, you know, the cast. So it's like, well, then it's like, well, if every super fan wrote about what was going on, or a good journalist like yourself that would find all this, and then the personal story, it just gave it a more universality to it. My opinion, I think it'll be reviewers looking at your book. I don't know if you are going through that process or the different things, but it's you can read about, if you wanted to get quotes from the cast, you had thousands of sources to choose from. Thousands of footnotes,
including the podcast.
And we're professional. You know about those footnote things. And I admire that you didn't. That is one of, you know, I think it has a very original book, and why I think you're going to get the word of mouth, and the you're going to find a lot of people who really weren't that big of fans of Luke, but who are of the same generation getting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I felt like if I got into the 90210 stories that like a lot of, especially a lot of the fans have like heard before, you know, like it would just reach out a lot of territory. And instead I did read everybody's, you know, I read Tori's biographies, I read, or Tori's, you know, memoirs. I read, you know, Jenny Carter's. I read, like all of them, you know, all of them. But, you know, I cherry picked out the things that I thought were really particularly interesting, or really sort of like had a heightened quality to them, like the like Tori, you know, Christmas story.
Is that where that comes from? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Some people are saying things. Sparkle says, I also miss him. Can't believe he's gone. So unfair. Lindy disagreed with you, Chuck, and said, I think you can argue most of the cast was pigeonholed based solely on the popularity of the show.
Yeah, but that's endemic to television, and nobody got that worse than our friend Ian Ziering.
Yep.
Ian Ziering is a multiply talented person. He can sing, he can dance. Finally, his career got a reverse when they did So You Think You Can Dance, or whatever it was, Dancing with the Stars. Right. And then it was all of a sudden, I can do more than that. This was a very talented, funny guy, this who had a put-em that everybody knows, oh, there's Steve Sanders. He got it the worst. The women were young and cute, and they all got nice, really nice roles. But Tori, Jenny, Shannon.
That's that's interesting. You're right that like the men kind of got it worse, you know, as far as the pigeon.
Except Brian, because Brian was a kid. And look, and now Brian is, you know, so studly gorgeous young man, young adult.
Well, you know, I also think it's something about the era, like back then, like there weren't many teenage shows. There wasn't any. You guys were basically one of, you know, the first. And like, I think that kind of also made it hard for people to break those actors out and allow them to be other people. Talking too about the era where like George Clooney was the guy on ER. He wasn't a movie star yet. And when he started being in movies, everyone was like, can he do it? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, ooh, there was this big gate.
George Clooney was the facts of life.
That's true.
That's true.
I have to say one thing, okay?
Yeah.
I was a young actor in Hollywood in 1981, and I got cast in The Facts of Life as the handsome National Guardsman who was going to carry Tootie out of the fire.
This happened to you? You got cast?
This happened to me. Eve Branson was a casting agent, and I get a call about a couple of days before, Eve saying, I have to make a switch.
Oh, God.
I'm paying the same amount of money, but I'm going to just give you the voiceover at the end. I'm paying the same amount of money. I have to have this other guy play the part. And that guy was George Clooney.
Oh, my God. Is this a true story, Larry? This is not true.
It was not a very big part. It was just at the last part.
Absolutely. And they brought him in, and he had more heat. And there it is. And
I lost my career over that. But yeah, that's what happened.
Amaya says Riverdale was really a dream come true for him. So sad he didn't get to experience it longer. You mentioned in the book... him rekindling his relationship with Shannon.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really touching, you know, like hearing from you, Chuck, that like, you know, and Larry, like they didn't always like see eye to eye. They didn't always get along. They didn't really click. Politically, obviously, really different. And then later on, though, I think, you know, they both grew up and, you know, water went under the bridge. And I think he also, you know, once she got diagnosed, I think he really just like his heart went out to her. And I thought that was a real sign of growth, too. You know, like part of what I wanted to capture in this book, you know, is just like growing up, like the fact that myself, him, like we all later in life, like sometimes our hearts get a little softer. You know, we know how to forgive better than we did when we were younger. And so I just like certain stories like that, I really wanted to bring to life because I felt like that was.
No, I understand that. Same thing with Ian. Ian and Shannon are very close now. I see them in photos together and they go out of their way to be together. And you know, he was not, they were at odds a lot. He was back in, especially in season four when things got out of hand.
Yeah, just, no. Shannon, like, I definitely, like, you know, in just reviewing all the history of the show, like, I think we sometimes all forget how incredibly young, you know, she was. I mean, there's always the joke about 90210. Oh, they were all, like, 30 years old when they were cast. It's like, actually, Shannon was 19, you know? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. She was really young.
And she was the showbiz kid. That's the thing that I know she talked, that you know, you grow up and you work as a child. And Brian had that experience. Brian was a show business kid, you know, is different. You know, when Luke was like, okay, I want to be an actor. I'm here in Ohio. I'm just going to be an actor. And so he's got that perseverance to keep trying on all those auditions. But, you know, he didn't have, I think of some of the actors I know who are from, you know, second generation show business families here in Los Angeles and how much, you know, training they get and exposure they get. And so Luke came out of, you know, left field in some ways and had to learn it all, not just, you know, about, you know, what do you do as an actor and how do you act in this, but also, you know, life lessons in the big city. You know, I always think he also grew. I'm blessed. I've been with my wife for, you know, lots of years, but, you know, also the pain of a divorce isn't great. Mm-hmm. And I know it was tough on him, must be tough on him. I really never, my only comment will be, and I, you know, I don't know when he and Mimi, came, when his wife got together, but we never spoke.
Never
looked at me and never spoke to me. And I always thought, well, Lucas really, you know, said a lot of wonderful things about you, about me, but I know that's not the case. So anyway.
It was interesting. Like when I reached out to her, she, like, one of the things she said when she was like, no, you know, I'm not going to do it, was she was like, it's just not me. And, you know, I think she was like, she really just like eschewed like the whole Hollywood. I don't think it was her bag. You know what I mean? Like, I think she really wanted to have like nothing to do with it.
She's into wrestling now.
Oh, Ryan's trying to do wrestling.
Jack is the, Jungle Boy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember from the book, like one of the stories I loved, or like one of the interviews that really shed some light on Luke, was Malcolm Jamal Warner. Like, you know, they were together on that show, Jeremiah, kind of a short-lived show, but has a cult following. But like, anyway, they got really close. They like experienced September 11th together, being the only Americans on this Canadian set, you know, making Jeremiah. And they became fast friends.
Were they in Vancouver?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it was basically Toronto, like, I was in Toronto at the other side of.
Oh, wow.
That was my airspace in 2001.
It was like the first or second day of shooting, and like 9/11 happens, you know, like crazy. And they're the only Americans there. And so they bond. And, you know, at the same time, Luke, I mean, at first his family is with him, then Minnie and the kids leave. And at some point he's getting a divorce. And, you know, he really confided in Malcolm Jamal Warner a lot. Like, he was really broken up about it, really heartbroken. And yeah, I just found that like a really touching story that I'd never really heard about him. Like, just kind of being, you know, being in Canada, making the show that was also really physically rigorous because they had to do a lot of shooting outside. It's like in a sort of post-apocalyptic show. And so they're always outside and like, you know, Vancouver rain and storms, and it was tough. And it was just like a tough period for him. But I loved that he made this connection with Malcolm Jamal that he, like, I'd never really heard about before. Mm.
Jessica says, oh, wow, they have it in audio form, too. So the book is in audio form, yes?
Yes, it is. Yeah, two great actors read it. Like, one, so one woman reads my side of the story, and then George Newborn reads Luke's side.
And he says that she's reading the book now. And then Justica, who's not Justina, I don't think, says doing the right thing when no one was looking, didn't want to be the center of attraction, but was a hero most of the time in that particular way, that it's very honorable.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, there's an idea, I think, in our culture that good people, kind people aren't complicated, you know, that right. Like, kind people are sort of simple and maybe even like dumb or something, you know, and we've kind of become really enthralled with like the anti-hero, the like Tony Sopranos of the world.
Sure.
And I really like had a good, I loved about this story, and part of my attraction to telling Luke's story was like, he was a good guy who was also complicated, you know, and like experienced a complicated life and had.
But he was the bad boy, but he was the bad boy in, you know, his image on TV,
right.
He was the bad boy, which was perfect.
Yeah.
When I was talking to Rory today, he mentioned about Luke on 90210 is that Luke had so much heart. He acted with so much heart. And so he was lovable. He was somebody that we all were getting behind and continued to keep watching the show for. And I, you know, obviously totally agree with that. Do any of you have any more questions about this book or any more thoughts, Chuck, that you wanted to add to this?
Oh, no, I think we've just done such a really good thing. Well, why did he, what was the thing about being to Tennessee? Was that to raise a family and be away from Hollywood? Was that the point of it?
I mean,
goodbye, money went farther in Tennessee. You could buy a lot of land. And
well, I think the other thing
about Jason moved there too. Luke did.
Well, yeah, but Jason's in Nashville, you know, yeah. It's a little, you know, a little different.
Right. Like Luke was in a more rural part. I mean, I think it definitely was like his way of connecting back with like a rural America that he always really treasured and valued. I mean, I think that was part of his like 8 seconds obsession, was sort of like tapping into that part of the world, the country. Like he always sort of stayed aligned with that group. I mean, not, you know, it's kind of, it was interesting to write this book in this sort of politically fractured moment we're in, where like the sort of red states, blue states narrative, because I feel like he is a person who really transcends that narrative. Like he has a lot of appeal in red states and blue states. And, you know, that is partially because of 8 seconds. Like he made that movie, and he made that movie really like not to the betterment of his career. Like it really kind of hurt him in a certain way. Critics didn't like it. His agent didn't want him to do it. Like, you know, it was a risk. Spelling didn't want him to do it. Like he did this role and you know, it was for a niche, you know, bullfighting. Like who wants to like.
Well, I always, when I was saying to Pete the other day, as I remember the look on his face when he was practicing bull riding and his bull riding instructor sees me from across the set, the, you know, the warehouse where we were, and goes, Rosen, is that you? Because I followed Rodeo Cowboys for about 6 months doing a movie for Henry Winkler at ABC. So I knew all these Rodeo Cowboys and bull riders.
That's hilarious.
And Luke was stunned because he, you know, we would never have talked about bull riding. It just wouldn't have been our overlap. Our overlap was, here's the work. This is what they're going to do. It. Okay, goodbye, goodbye. You know, and otherwise, so, you know, that was that one moment. That's why I say I know how much that was, because he had no idea that I had spent time with these guys. And, you know, when I was around a lot of, apropos of the era we live in now, red state, blue state, all of that, I would be around the Rodeo Cowboys. They would tell politically incorrect jokes, and I kept having to go, guys, I'm Jewish, you know, to lighten up. You know, that was the, you know, the 1980 version of anti-Semitism, but it was there too. It was there.
Yeah.
The 8 seconds also brought that incredible episode of 90210 Wild Horses, where Luke is out on the field.
We watched it. Pete, yeah. You laughed at it because you realized that
it wasn't as bad as I remembered.
20 minutes of real shit. I got we cut out of there, and it became a story about our cat.
That's right.
All right. No story anymore.
Yeah. I just want to say, Margaret, thank you so much for writing this book. I know that the fans are super excited about it. I'm super excited about it. Doing this podcast, I've gotten to learn so much about Luke Perry, someone that I loved and adored. And you got to write something that everybody will hopefully get a chance to read about their favorite person. You did a beautiful job. I mean, you're getting high praise from Chuck Rosen and Larry Mullen, who don't really give high praise. So.
Oh, wait a second. I give a lot of high praise to Oppenheimer. And Barbie. Thank you very much.
And Barbie. Yeah.
That was equally as great. So,
yeah. But really great job. And I hope that the cast does get a chance to read it, because you didn't talk out of school. You talked about things that had been talked about and just showcased this wonderful human being. And I'm just so appreciative that you made this and you wrote this.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, I have to say to you guys that I massively appreciate this podcast, because it was a huge research tool. I mean, I listened to, so many episodes, and certain episodes, as you see in the book, I like go back to again and again, and they're real touchstones for me and really like informed a certain idea about Luke that I had. And also just like, it put me in the time and place of making that show. You know, there was a pretty early show you guys did where you just talk about Chuck, you in particular, talk a lot about kind of just the daily ins and outs of making that show and it being like a non-union show, for example, and like having to sort of like kick, you know, people off the beach because you needed to film there. Like that kind of stuff just really, you know, it's those small details that just make a writer like, you know, so happy, like I can feel it.
A couple things. Amy says, I'm reading it now and super thankful that Margaret did this book. Sparkle says, thank you, Margaret. And Stephen says that, or Stephen, I don't know. Thank you. This was awesome. I've been watching from a hospital bed in Australia, and I will continue listening to the audio book. Thank you. And Sparkle said, this podcast is amazing. I'm so grateful for this form. So. There you go. This has been great. Any final thoughts from anyone else? Larry, do you have any final thoughts or anything?
Yeah, people are going to find this book. And like I said, when it gets translated into other languages, you got to get another boost on it, because there's just ferocious fans all around the world who are multi-generational, and you're going to see it. And yeah, I wish you the best with it. I'm glad we were able to help you and keep, because it all, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats. We're in the 90s.
Exactly. Yeah, you guys, I mean, I'm just, thank you all for participating in the interviews. Like, Pete, you were one of the very first people I reached out to, and you were a lifeline, you know, kind of patching me through to people like Rory Karp, who just had a beautiful story and connection as both a fan and a friend. So I'm just so grateful to you guys. And
we're super grateful for you, too. So thanks so much. We will see everybody next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.